the music. Cut the music.
I think I got my swagger back.
Spectacular group of men. You go find them, you throw your arms around them, you give them a big kiss on the mouth if you're a girl.
Oh, the band is out on the field. He's going to go into the end zone.
There goes Davis.
Oh, my God.
Davis is going to run it all the way back. Auburn's going to win the football game. Auburn's going to win the football game.
Like poison. Like rat poison.
Are you going to listen to me or are you going to listen to these guys?
And welcome to the College Football Country Podcast. My name is Josh Parcell, the founder of College Football Country, CFBCountry.com, for more from the voice of college football fans. Every single day we're talking college football on the website and, of course, the podcast, which you're listening to right now. This episode will be devoted to the ACC. And lo and behold, biggest stories in the country this week, right here in ACC country. You've got Kelly Bryant transferring out of Clemson. You've got Virginia Tech losing in the most surprising, shocking, unbelievable upset of the entire college football season to this point. Thank you guys again for listening. Don't forget, I'm still looking for more ratings. We're getting closer every single day to that 150 mark. I'm looking for 155 star reviews. If you can get me there, one of you will win a $25 Amazon gift card. How do you win? Give me your most random or your favorite college football player of all time. You got to drop it in the name in the review. It asks for your name. I want it to be Major Harris. I want it to be Macho Harris. I want it to be some other guy named Harris. I just need it to be a college football star from a way long time ago. It's going to make me laugh. It's going to make the reviews look funny. It's going to make you look funny. And it might even win you $25. So make sure you leave that review. When I hit 150 on Apple, we'll be good. We will get that prize out to you by the end of the season as long as we hit 150. And don't forget, you can review it on Stitcher. You can review it on Google Play as well. If that's where you're listening, I will include you as well, but I do want to hit that 150 mark on Apple before I make a call. So your review won't count towards the 150, but if we get to 150, I will look at the reviews on the other podcast platforms as well. Without further ado, let's get to the show. Kyle Bailey joined me this week to talk about Clemson, talk about Virginia Tech, and boy, is there some drama in the ACC. And with that, I welcome on Kyle Bailey. Kyle, not a lot to talk about this week, right?
No, you don't even need me for this week.
I'm telling you what, I am ramped up and ready to go. Thursday and Friday from 10 to 2, I'm going to be riding solo. There's no Nick Wilson this week, so I'm going to get my chance to vent about the Hokies and talk about Kelly Bryant, but figured I couldn't wait another day, so we got to talk about it right now. And Kyle, I'll be honest, I got to lead off. We got to talk about Kelly. We got to talk about Clemson and the news that, I'll be honest, didn't really surprise me. I thought I could have seen this coming for a while.
Yep.
They gave Kelly Bryant a chance to win this job. They did. And through the first 4 weeks, he played roughly the same number of possessions as Trevor Lawrence. I think Lawrence got maybe one or two more series. But for all intents and purposes, these two guys split snaps almost evenly through the first 4 weeks. I think that I have enough respect and faith in Dabo Swinney that he wouldn't pull that over on Kelly Bryant and for the optics of it. I think Dabo Swinney truly wanted to give Kelly Bryant a chance to win the job. Because as much attention, as much hype as Trevor Lawrence had, he's a five-star recruit, number one quarterback recruit in the country. We know what the potential is for Trevor Lawrence. Reality is you don't know until the guy steps out on the field and plays. There's been plenty of freshmen, plenty of five-star guys who haven't lived up to the hype. So I think until Clemson got to see enough of Trevor Lawrence to say, all right, this guy's not going to completely be a bust. He is ready to play now. I think that was when Dabo Swinney knew he could make the call. Now, he expedited that decision because the rule that's in place now by the NCAA that says that if you play four games but no more, you can redshirt, and in Kelly Bryant's case, he'll be able to transfer because of that. I think Dabo, that was calculated. It was calculated that he was making the call after week four. But I don't think that he played Kelly Bryant just for the sake of playing him.
I think he truly wanted. That's not what I was hinting at.
What do you think of the situation?
All I was wondering was, look, I'm with you. Matter of fact, Frank R.C. and I, my co-host on weekdays, we argued about this. You know that. I told him, I said, that Trevor Lawrence will be the starter by the middle of the season. Like, he will be. And, you know, we argued back and forth about that. But the reason I brought that up is that I had confidence this would happen. But also, you know, to say by design splitting snaps, well, okay, maybe that's what you've got there, but you've also got a perfectly or at least close to equal sample size to back up whatever decision you make there as well. You know, so it's not – I didn't mean to say that there's some sort of optics game being played so much as, hey, you're going to win no matter what with that defense and those athletes, no matter who's under center the first part of the schedule. There's no question about that. So, split the snaps down the middle, see what it looks like. You already know what kind of decision you're probably going to make. At least you'll have something there to inform it if you don't make that decision.
Right. And, you know, Kelly Bryant, I'm sure, has so much confidence in himself. He said as much in the report when he announced that he was transferring, that he thought he had done enough to earn the job. And to be honest, Clemson would be just fine with Kelly Bryant at quarterback. They would win the ACC. They would make the college football playoff just like they did a year ago. The reality is when they go up against Alabama, they need somebody who can actually beat Alabama with their arm. Kelly Bryant can't do that. I think that that was a big factor in making this decision. The thing that I want to talk about most with this entire thing is this new rule and the unintended consequence that it has brought along, in the fact that you have not only Kelly Bryant, but you have Nate Craig-Meyers at Auburn, starting wide receiver for the Auburn Tigers. You have the kid from McCleskey, Jalen McCleskey from Oklahoma State, leading receiver for Oklahoma State, or one of the leading receivers, transfers out after 4 weeks. What you have now is you have guys who are established players in the program, third and fourth year players, upperclassmen, who just quite simply aren't happy with the role they have on the team, but are playing. I mean, playing significant time, significant snaps, playing major roles on great football teams, and they're just up and leaving because they're unhappy after 4 weeks. I give all of the credit in the world to the players for making the decision that's in their best interest. I don't fault Kelly Bryant for doing what he did this week in transferring out. That was looking out for him, which is what he should be doing. What I think the NCAA needs to say is, we'll apply that 4-game redshirt rule if you are either a freshman, or I'll even go so far as to say underclassman. But if you are a freshman or a younger player, go ahead and allow them to play 4 games, because that was the spirit of the rule in the first place. The spirit of the rule was to allow freshmen or younger players the opportunity to play without having to burn a redshirt. Maybe it's a bowl game. Maybe it's in spot duty if a player goes down late in the season with an injury. That was what was happening, was these kids were playing in November for a quarter or a half or whatever, and then they were losing an entire year because of it. That was the spirit of the rule, but now you're seeing these older upperclassmen exploit the rule, which they have every right to do the way it's designed. I just don't think that's fair to the team. If you're an upperclassman and you're unhappy with your situation or the staff, transfer in August. Because if the old rule was in place, I firmly believe this, if the old rule was in place this year, Dabo Swinney would have named Trevor Lawrence the starter in August, and Kelly Bryant would have transferred out then, which is what was happening with a lot of quarterback battles over the last few years anyway. So I think if you can go back to that, that, A, protects the player's interest. They're still able to transfer if they're unhappy with their situation. But it also allows the team a chance to go forward with a roster that they know is intact.
Neither one of these sides was wrong to do what they did,
right?
In my opinion. Neither side was wrong to handle it the way they handled it. I thought Dabo did it with class. I thought he did it with the best interest of the program in mind. I think I could make a strong case that he did it with the best interest of Kelly Bryant in mind in certain ways. It does sting for Kelly Bryant. I understand that, too, because he's 16-2 as a starter. I mean, his teammates love him. They tend to trust him, you would think, but Trevor Lawrence has a much higher upside. He's the better option. So all of this seems rather obvious, but it's also to say that it's complicated, and I don't know that I can – yours isn't a bad idea, but I wonder, is it as simple as putting a time restriction on it, you know, any number of weeks into the season as well? Would that possibly make more sense? I would have to think it out a little bit further, but I think the bottom line is we're just heading in a direction kind of en masse here where these guys do have more rights and they do have more options. And that's a good thing. And it's going to get a little bit muddied, and I'm going to try not to make too big a deal out of the things that probably shouldn't be made too big a deal out of. And is this one of those things? And I'm asking, not because I'm telling you it is, because I'm not sure. Does that make sense?
I think we
may see this influx of upperclassmen transferring 4 weeks into the season because they're not happy with their current job. And that I get that. But at the same time, that's the system we've got right now, and we're still in the kind of early phases of what college football is going to look like 5 to 7 years from now. So I don't know. I don't know if this is one of those just big problems that needs to be fixed, or is it a symptom that needs to be looked at? This is very complicated. I'm not sure. I just know that I don't fault either side for the way they handled it, and right. I hope Kelly Bryant finds a great situation for him, because it stinks, you know, all the way around.
Yeah, I think when we go back at the end of the day, this is an NCAA problem, which, go figure, that seems to always be the case with all of these things.
Is that too philosophical, by the way?
I'm a big believer in the idea that sometimes we take a one case or one or two cases and we use that to be representative of a larger problem.
Right.
And sometimes it's not. This applies not just to sports, but to society as a whole. We see something, a video or a story on social media, and it goes viral, and people think, oh my God, this is a problem with our society or with this industry. And in reality, it might not be. I've used the same rationale to talk about the hits on the quarterback in the NFL, where in reality, there's only been about a dozen or less called penalties in the first few weeks of the season, and we're saying this is a big epidemic. It's actually only happening in a couple games a week. Not to go down that rabbit hole, but to say, is this an instance where we have a couple high-profile cases of guys transferring, and all of a sudden we think this is a big problem that needs to be addressed? I could see that argument, where you're basically saying, all right, Kelly Bryant, Nate Craig Myers, McCleskey at Oklahoma State, are three guys really worth revamping an entire rule that's helping probably more players than it's hurting? I could see that. Having said that, I'm all for player mobility, player freedom, independence to move and take control of their career. They're only there for 4 years. They're probably not earning enough. I mean, I think you and I are both falling the same side of that. They deserve more compensation for what they're doing.
Or at least fewer restrictions.
I don't believe that the solution is letting guys walk out on their team in the middle of the season.
It's a valid argument.
Middle of the season is, I can't square myself with that.
It's a valid argument. I get that because you're right. The spirit of this game especially, in any sport, but the spirit of this game especially, is that it takes 11 guys. You know, that it's the ultimate team sport. And you are putting forth new rules and bringing forth, I guess, scenarios in which guys can much more freely walk away from their teams. That stinks. You know, but that's a decision, an individual decision, that these guys, I think, should be allowed to make. I mean, Vontae Davis just walked out on his team at halftime. You know, of a Buffalo Bills game, professional football, just said, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. I'm retiring. He did it. Yeah, he's a little bit older, but, I mean, we can't protect everyone from everything all the time, and I'm just not sure if this is something that we need to be protected from because, okay, Dabo Swinney's got two really, really good quarterbacks. Well, what if he loses one of them? Okay, what if, right? Have a third guy, I guess, is the answer. I don't know. Recruit well enough to overcome that. You know, plan better. I'm not sure. I just think that this is one of those issues where, okay, if it becomes an epidemic a year from now, let's try to find a solution to this. But until then, I think we just kind of have to let it go for a little bit.
Yeah, you don't want to make snap judgments.
Right.
You don't want to just overreact so quickly. I can see that. I think it may change the way some of these big-time programs recruit where maybe instead of just trying to sign every single five-star every year, yeah, you go after those guys, but maybe find a three-star who's content just – playing for the Clemson Tigers.
Guy you want to develop.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then you're kind of safe. Now, Clemson has Chase Bryce, who was a four-star recruit. He's a talented enough player. So it's going to affect the way you recruit, and it might affect the way you approach preseason camp and the way you prepare these guys so that in the event that you have a guy transfer out, you are more prepared. We've seen the same thing happen at Nebraska. Little different scenario, Scott Frost in his first year trying to overhaul the roster, but Nebraska lost their backup quarterback to a transfer in August when Scott Frost made a call, and now it's costing Nebraska where, I mean, they've just trotted out a wounded Adrian Martinez against Michigan a week ago and got their, you know, their tails handed to them. So there's a lot of variables in this, I think, that we can both agree on. I just think that the spirit of the rule wasn't designed for this specifically to happen.
No.
And
I think you said it best, unintended consequences, what this is.
Exactly. And that happens with so many rule changes, NCAA or not. There's always unintended consequences when you try to make sweeping changes to an entire system. The one last thing I'll make on this is that the idea that we shouldn't feel bad for the coaches because they're losing guys and the coaches get paid millions of dollars. I get that. I'm not trying to give all this sympathy to college football coaches. I do give sympathy to the players and to the teammates on the roster that Kelly Bryant went to battle with for the last few weeks. You want to go back last few years. I don't know that it's all that fair to his teammates that now they could end up suffering because of this rule that, again, he exploited fairly, but it's a rule that allowed basically the program to be in a state of flux. And now you've got 84 other guys on scholarship or however many guys are on that team altogether that now all of a sudden their fortunes have radically changed. And I've said
have
this.
Have they, though?
If Trevor Lawrence gets hurt, yeah.
Well, okay, if he
but,
does.
But, I mean, that it definitely it changes. And Kelly Bryant's an interesting example because he's a backup quarterback, but you even talk Oklahoma State losing a key receiver.
Right.
Other key players, it's just – It reeks of selfishness. I'm not saying it's the wrong kind of selfishness, but it's hard as a team or as a teammate of that guy not to feel betrayed a little bit. It's tough.
This is the exact conversation we had in the newsroom earlier because, you know, Frank used the word selfish. I used the word selfish. And by the strict definition of the word, yeah, it meets, but it carries a very negative connotation. And you're right. Is there a right and wrong kind of selfish? I don't know. What I do know is that as an individual, Kelly Bryant is looking at this saying, well, I have to look out for me because the program, the university, is not going to look out for me before it looks out for itself. Yes, you have teammates. And again, yes, I think we're kind of talking about the more romanticized part of football, the camaraderie, the teamwork, the counting on one another. And those things are awesome. It's why we love sports. But we're also seeing, little by little, the pebbles kind of pulled away from this NCAA mountain to where, first it was graduate transfer loophole that, we really got to figure out what it was all about. And, it's been a succession of things through the cost of attendance and snacks and, player representation. And now we're talking about, 4 weeks into the season. It's all just a gradual erosion of what the NCAA has and always been. And I think this is just one of those steps along that line. And that is why I'm not too apt to get worked up about this right now. But in terms of leaving the teammates, guys leave teammates for a variety of reasons. Guys don't do their homework. They don't go to class. They get kicked off the team. They get busted doing drugs. They beat up a woman on campus. There are a variety of reasons that you can lose a teammate. And a guy walking away, that might feel like a gut punch, but does it change your fortunes any more than if a guy just got hurt and wasn't available? So, no, that's how I see it right now. Kelly Bryant did what Kelly Bryant had to do for himself. Dabo Swinney did what he thought was in the best interest of his program. I think Trevor Lawrence, like many other people do, is extremely special. I think that kid's going to be the number one overall draft pick here in a couple of years. So you got to play him. And you got to play him because you're not winning a national championship against Alabama if you get there with Kelly Bryant at quarterback. And no, Trevor Lawrence is not ready to do that right now, but the hope is that by season's end he will be, because you'd be losing the damn game either way if Kelly Bryant started.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about Clemson's future now that Trevor Lawrence is the guy. And let's be honest, Clemson's schedule is beyond atrocious the rest of the way. They've got NC State in 3 weeks. They've got Florida State at the end of the month, South Carolina at the end of the year. Duke is actually the only team left on Clemson's schedule that's in the top 25 right now. I highly doubt the Blue Devils are ranked when that game actually comes around. But Clemson has the easiest schedule left in the country of any team that has national championship aspirations. Okay, nobody else that's in the top 5 or 6 can say that they don't play any team in the top 20 the rest of the way. Clemson, by all accounts, should run the table, no matter who was playing quarterback in the regular season. Even in the ACC championship game, nobody in the Coastal looks like a true threat right now. I think Miami could eventually emerge as one, but we saw what happened last year when they took on Clemson. I don't think it would really be any different this time around. Mm-hmm. Having said that, you do run the risk with Trevor Lawrence of an upset taking place. You had that same risk with Kelly Bryant. It happened a year ago. It happened 2 years ago. Clemson has lost games it shouldn't have lost each of the last two seasons.
Sure.
What they've been able to do is overcome that because they've had quality wins on their resume, whether it was beating Louisville or whether it was beating Florida State a couple years ago, or they had a handful of wins that boosted up their resume. And this is where I go with the Clemson situation. Not that Trevor Lawrence really changed my opinion on this. It's more so looking at their schedule. In the history of the college football playoff, the committee has shown, while they've been inconsistent on some things, they've shown they value quality wins way more than they penalize bad losses.
Yeah.
Teams that lose to 500 teams, sub 500 teams, as long as you've beaten a lot of really good teams too, they're willing to overlook that one black mark on your resume. Happened to Clemson, happened to Ohio State in 2014.
Yep.
It's happened time and again where teams have had bad losses, but they've overcome it because they've had quality wins. Clemson's not going to have that luxury this year.
No.
If a team sneaks up on the Tigers and beats them, and you can say what you want right now that it doesn't look like it's going to happen. It didn't look like it was going to happen last year either. It didn't look like it was going to happen 2 years ago, but it did. If Trevor Lawrence, who's a freshman and
this
as
whole
talented
weekend just
as he
showed
is,
us that that's possible.
Exactly. You never know. These are 18, 19, 20-year-old kids who can get complacent, who can read their own press clippings, and can lose. And Clemson has a track record of doing this. If Trevor Lawrence, as a freshman, has a dud, has a bad game, all of a sudden you don't have Kelly Bryant to turn to save you. You have to ride it out with this kid, and they lose a game to a Duke or to an NC State, or I can't see it happening to Florida State, but you never know. They don't have the quality wins to boost that resume. And now all of a sudden, a 12-1 Clemson team, it might not make the playoff.
No.
As great as they've been, they made it 3 straight years. I don't know that they would get the benefit of the doubt. Alabama gets the benefit of the doubt. Like it or not, they get the benefit of the doubt when they're a one-loss team. They did last year. I don't know that Clemson has the kind of cachet yet that would give them a tiebreaker over the likes of a one-loss Washington or maybe even a one-loss Big 12 champion. Oklahoma it could be, or even Texas at this point, West Virginia. There's plenty of teams. I think that any team from any other conference is going to have, assuming they're a one-loss conference champ, is going to have more quality wins than Clemson, and I think that that would get them in over the Tigers. So Clemson is running the risk with Trevor Lawrence because he's a freshman, but just running the risk because of their schedule, which is out of their control, that they might miss the playoff if they lost a game.
They would miss the playoff. I don't have any doubt about that right now, because I think the ACC is the worst conference in the country right now. I do. Do you agree? Do you disagree?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question.
It's the worst conference in the country right now. And I hate to say that as an ACC guy, but it is what it is. I mean, you went from 2 years ago, this league in July at the ACC kickoff, beating its chest, we're the best conference in the country, national championship, Heisman Trophy, so on and so forth, to now 2 years later, a complete regression, you know, to what everyone made fun of this conference for being 5-6 years ago. The worst conference in the country, 12-1 with a loss, does not get Clemson into the national championship game. Who is the only team in the Atlantic Division that could still present itself as a good win for Clemson? NC State?
I mean, NC State at this point, Boston College could have been that team until they laid an egg against Purdue, right. Yeah, I mean, there is no Atlantic team that's going to be a quality win. Duke is the only team left on the schedule that's ranked.
Even if Miami wins out, right? I mean, even if Miami wins out, let's say...
Possible, right.
But if Miami wins out... And their only loss is to LSU, which right now, I mean, it's not a bad loss. They got their tails whipped, but it's not a bad loss by any stretch. An 11-1 Miami team beating that team with the only loss being to LSU in the opening week might be good enough.
It's going to be very close.
But I don't think – it's hard. At the same time, though, they still want the biggest brands in this thing, man. They do. I mean, this football committee, this college football playoff committee wants the biggest brands in this thing, because it's still a big television show at end of the day. And so if it comes down to Clemson or, I don't know, you tell me, TCU, Clemson or, I don't know, Washington, who's going to travel? You know, who's going to sell more tickets? Who's going to put more eyes on the television? Who is it?
I mean, that's a I don't want to go so far as to call it a conspiracy theory.
No, it's not, but it is what it is.
But it certainly happened with bowl selection in plenty of years, and you could argue it happened last year with the playoff by getting Alabama in at number 4, even though they didn't win the SEC. I think Washington is going to be the team that, if Clemson were to lose one game, and that's a huge hypothetical, because right now it looks like they're going to run the table. But to go down that rabbit hole, if it was a one-loss Clemson, I think Washington's going to be the team knocking on the door. If they were the one-loss Pac-12 champion, because they would have run the table in the Pac-12. Their only loss would have been to Auburn. Okay, that's a pretty good loss as well. Probably a equal loss. You could debate better or worse than Miami losing more by a bigger margin to LSU. But Washington would have beaten Stanford. They would have beaten Oregon. And that's probably the two most quality wins they would have. Nobody from the Pac-12 South right now. That's the other best-kept secret in college football. The Pac-12 South is actually probably worse than the ACC Coastal, which is horrible to say. But you're talking about a Washington team that would have two quality wins, in theory, Oregon and Stanford, and a much better loss than whatever Clemson would have. I mean, if you're playing this game, Clemson's loss would be to a team that's probably outside the top 25.
Right.
So Washington would have the loss to a top 25 Auburn team, assuming they still are there at the end of the year, and then they would have two quality wins. I think Washington's going to be an interesting team to be fighting for that playoff bid, or Stanford, who I actually picked Stanford to win the Pac-12, but right now Washington is still the odds-on favorite. We'll find out more about the Cardinal this weekend against Notre Dame, but it's going to be interesting. I mean, Clemson's going to have a tough time making a case if they were to lose a game, so that just goes to say the margin is slim. Remember last year when Clemson lost to Syracuse, Kelly Bryant got hurt in that game.
Yeah.
And they had to turn to a backup quarterback who was not ready to play. And to Syracuse's credit, they were winning the game when Kelly Bryant went down. Right. People like to bring that up. But regardless, you lost a quarterback in a game, and you lost the game. If Trevor Lawrence goes out and Clemson loses, how much – this goes back to the whole thing. How much does the committee weigh that at the end of the year? They're supposed to take that into account. But I don't know that they're going to be able to square themselves with a team that would be sitting there 12-1 and would have their best win would have been against an 8-4 NC State. I just don't think that's going to be enough for Clemson. So they're playing with fire because of the schedule, and I think that's something that Clemson fans might deep down know, but they certainly don't want to admit.
No, and honestly, they'd just be a victim of circumstance at that point, right? And that stinks because the rest of the conference can't hold up its own bargain, can't hold up its own weight. I mean, that's sad.
This is why we're not going to have this debate right now. I refuse. This is why the playoff needs to be eight.
No, I'm with you. It's eight.
Because you cannot have five major conferences and four playoff spots. It's unfair to a team like Clemson, who is so dominant in a league that is so bad, and they have no margin for error, while a team, we just said, losing a bad game doesn't hurt you as much as winning three good ones. Alabama could have lost to Ole Miss. Let's just make that up. Alabama could have lost to Ole Miss, and if they ran the table the rest of the way and beat LSU and Mississippi State and Auburn and Georgia, they would have easily gotten in because they had the chances to do so. You're taking away that opportunity from a team like Clemson because they play in a Power 5 league that just might not have the same type of quality opponents as somebody else.
Yeah, but Josh, it devalues the regular season.
You know what's funny is that the playoff actually did devalue the regular season. It didn't devalue the entertainment value, but it devalued the importance of every single game to a team.
So who cares?
No, nobody cares.
Nobody cares.
That's the thing.
No one cares because why do people watch football? To be entertained.
To be entertained for the drama, all that. And it still exists.
And why do people watch college football specifically? To be entertained for the drama. Because there are plenty of programs out there that people love and care deeply about. And they like to think they have a chance to win a national championship, but deep down inside they know they're not winning the national championship, yet they still watch every single Saturday.
Oh, yeah.
So, this whole devaluing the regular season thing has always been kind of nonsense to me. Plus, we're going to ask these kids to play extra games. Well, okay, then maybe pay them. Or, you know, stop sending these FCS programs out to slaughter in Tuscaloosa or anywhere else, to get these kids. There are solutions out there.
I know.
Smart people have come up with viable solutions to get this thing to eight. There's no good reason why every level of football decides their national champion with a tournament-style playoff except for big-time college football. There's no rational explanation for it other than we like money.
It's amazing. You're right. And it's amazing to me that people who refuse to admit that it's devalued the regular season, twice in 4 years, the number four seed has won the college football playoff. Now, what that means is this. The margins between four and five are so slim, first of all. Okay. Actually, both times that those teams won, which was Alabama last year and Ohio State the first year, there was a pretty big controversy when those teams got in. Which means that going into the playoff, we thought that the number five team, there was a lot of people who thought the number five team was better than the team that ended up winning the national championship. Does that not tell you there are more than four teams capable of winning at all? There are. And on top of that, it tells you that a loss, let's use Clemson for example. Clemson losing to Syracuse last year under a two-team system, they're done. Season's over.
Right.
Or Ohio State losing to Virginia Tech. They're done. I mean, that is the odds of making the national championship if you lose a game to a bad football team before the playoff was instituted, before a four-team playoff was instituted, that was a death sentence. It was over.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you're allowed a mulligan as long as you pick up those quality wins along the way. I say that all to say that the devaluing of the regular season, which was one of the biggest pushbacks when they expanded to four, really hasn't impacted the interest level or the entertainment value of the game whatsoever.
You know what it has devalued? Bowl games. That's what it's devalued. I mean, or at least it has decreased the importance of bowl games. I'll be honest. I love college football. I still watch bowl games. I don't watch as many of them as I used to. Maybe that's a product of the playoff. Maybe it's not, though. If I'm being honest, that's like a causation correlation thing that I can't figure out.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly what it is, but
There's too many bowl games.
Well, there are.
That's the problem. Sorry, not to sidetrack you.
But it has devalued bowl games. Nick Saban's talked about that. Lots of guys have talked about that. But you know what? Who cares? They're exhibition football games. For sponsors to dole out prizes and to roll out big signage and place, funny commercials and, just celebrate themselves for an entire week, right? What about the playoff is stopping anyone from doing that?
Right.
So you can continue to do those things, continue to enjoy the bowl system if you want to, go to eight. You're asking two teams to play an extra game, and if it's really that egregious, again, stop paying $750,000 for Savannah State to come get slaughtered in front of your home crowd.
Exactly.
It doesn't serve anyone. No one should have to pay face value for that garbage, and it's just an inferior product. It's bad.
Exactly. No, you're exactly right, and I think that the issue of the playoff and the issue of why bowl game interest might be down are two separate issues. I think we've been overexposed to bowl games as they've grown and grown and grown, and now there's over 40 bowl games. People just don't have the time to watch 40 games as much as we'd like to. We don't have the time to watch those games over a two-week span. You go back 15 years ago, there were 20 bowl games, 23 bowl games. I mean, it was very limited. So the teams that were playing in those bowls were at worst, 7-win teams. I mean, really, you're talking 8 and 9-win teams are playing in bowls. I understand why it's gotten to this point, and honestly, as a proponent of the players and the experience of playing college football, I'm not going to die on the hill of saying there should be less bowl games.
No.
Yes, it takes away from my entertainment value, but I would be inconsistent if I were to say that there should be less bowl games, because I think that it is more about what's fair to the players and giving them the best experience possible than it is. Why should my experience sitting on my couch be more valuable than the players who are actually putting in the hours and the time and the work to play in these games?
Right. No one's forcing me to buy a ticket. No one's forcing me to watch
Correct.
It. You're not hurting anybody. You're paying your own money to play a football game. If you want to do that, knock yourselves out. And if it's a compelling enough matchup, I might watch it. You know, but if not, why? I don't understand people who care so much. They get just irrationally angry about there being too many bowl games. Don't watch them. It's a very simple solution.
Yeah.
Don't watch them. Like, these guys enjoy going to them. You know, it's a vacation. They get cool swag. I mean, maybe they don't love the playing part so much if it's a meaningless game. But, I mean, there are plenty of good things about them. So, yeah, you're absolutely right.
They're not going away. They shouldn't go away. But I do think that there's some people who mistake the playoff for ruining the bowl system. And if you really break it down, I don't think that they're related whatsoever. I mean, yes, maybe there's more of a build-up to a playoff, whereas before there was one game and – I don't know. You could go into the psychology of that, but I just don't think that that's really been the primary driving factor behind it. But I do think it should go to 8, and I think that would be fair for a team like Clemson if they were to lose a game in the season. I do want to talk about Virginia Tech. We can get to that now, because why wait any longer? Why put off our misery? What was that? I mean, I have watched a lot of college football over my life. Almost every Saturday, from noon until 2 a.m., that's all I'm doing. This past Saturday, I was moving into my new apartment and thought I was going to have DirecTV installed. Whole big fiasco. Didn't happen. Didn't have access to a TV all day long. I had to leave moving in with my family. They were down to help me, and I forced us – well, my dad wanted to do it, but girlfriend and mom, not so much – forced them to go out to a bar to watch that. I wasted 4 hours of my life where I could have been all moved in, all settled in by Saturday night, and instead I had to watch a Bud Foster defense give up 632 yards to an Old Dominion team that lost by 6 touchdowns to Liberty.
To a kid without a single Division I offer coming out of high school and a former walk-on who came out of nowhere and threw for 500 freaking yards on Bud's defense.
How on earth do you explain this?
I don't know how. It's just one of the that's football. That's one of those things. I don't even Army took Oklahoma into overtime this weekend. I mean, how did App State beat Michigan? How did, you know, Jacksonville State beat Ole Miss? How did Georgia Southern beat Florida a couple of years ago? These things happen. They do. I mean, the Citadel almost beat I'm having a brain cramp right now. The Citadel almost knocked somebody off not too long ago. I mean, it's college football. And what happened, I think, very simply can be summed up as that was a Bud Foster defense with a bunch of potential liabilities that already scared the hell out of a lot of fans going into the season, and they got a false sense of hope and security after the Florida State win, when it turned out that Florida State's not a very good football team, but they got a false sense of security that Bud Foster's defense has already arrived and has been completely developed, you know, in some of these kids' very first game of their careers, and that just was not the case. And so when they got out to ODU – and they're playing at a place where they're supposed to go out there, stomp this team, make a statement, because this is recruiting their backyard, you know, in the Hampton Road 757 area. And they get out there, and it's almost as if they forgot. These are under-recruited 2- and 3-star kids with a chip on their shoulder. I don't care what the record was. A lot of these kids wanted offers from Virginia Tech, you know, and some of the other, you know, regional big-time FBS,
oh, yeah.
And they didn't get them. But that area, as you well know, and a lot of the listeners out there know, just does nothing but produce big-time athletes. You saw the running back. They got 2 legitimate wide receivers. I have no idea how they've lost the first 3 games of the season. I didn't watch a ton of ODU football, so quite frankly, I don't feel qualified to talk about that. But I do know I saw some guys out there playing with some fire, guys that play with a chip. And that Virginia Tech defense got punched in the mouth and didn't really know how to respond. And Justin Fuente said as much. They got caught in a football game, and they just didn't respond. And they became the laughing stock of college football for a day for the third time in 20 years.
And that's the part that I think stings the most for Virginia Tech fans, is the fact that we've seen this movie before, and yet again they're standing here today as the laughingstock of college football for a week. Look, I can tell you exactly what happened. This was a team that was unprepared. This was a team that thought that they could walk into Norfolk and win the game, and they're a young team that, honestly, Justin Fuente, I think, saw a letdown coming. I don't know that he saw an upset coming, but he said as much after the game. He told his team, I liked you a lot more when everyone thought you were terrible. Yep. That was a great line from Justin Fuente, and he's spot on. And Virginia Tech fell victim to that. Look, the Florida State game covered up a lot of warts on this team, and people fell hook, line, and sinker for the name brand and the logo on the helmet of Florida State and thought that the Hokies went in and beat a legitimate top 20 team, myself included. A lot of us thought the same thing. What we didn't do is take what happened over the next 2 weeks for face value or at face value. Florida State struggling against Samford, and then, I mean, absolutely being annihilated by Syracuse.
I disagree with you there. I absolutely – when I saw what happened – Samford, seriously, first half of Samford, they're down 13 to nothing. They look like a mess. That's when I realized this team's not good. Mm-hmm. And even coming out of that game on Monday night, I thought, okay, Tech's defense is better than we thought it was, but I still don't know if that team right there is any good. It confirmed it for me at Samford, and then that's why I picked them to lose, you know, a couple of weeks ago against Syracuse in the Carrier Dome. It was completely predictable. So this ODU was a shock to me, but this team being overrated was not in the least because we've seen this story before. I was not fooled by the William & Mary win. Like, none of that got to me. I thought they were at least good. I didn't think they were capable of that on Saturday, but I didn't think they were great.
And nor shouldn't they be. I mean, this – It was a tough pill to swallow for any Hokie fan, but I was blinded a little bit to some of the flaws on the team. What we saw on Saturday was the extreme end of the biggest fears for this Virginia Tech team coming into the season. It was a young secondary, I mean, a young defense really at every level. It was inconsistent quarterback play. It was all of the questions that you heard about this team in August, and people just overlooked them for the most part, some more than others, after Florida State. They were exposed. They had no business losing the game. If you want to pinpoint blame in the game, it falls on the defense in my mind because 35 points should be enough to beat ODU. Was it a flawless performance by the offense? Absolutely not. Okay, Josh Jackson was erratic at times, but the running game was outstanding. Stephen Peoples ran wherever he wanted. McLeese ran the ball well as well. The defense cannot do what the defense said. I mean, you talk about the most yards in the history of Bud Foster's tenure at Virginia Tech. Old Dominion now has that record. That is baffling, and that's unacceptable for Virginia Tech. And
it's mind blowing.
It doesn't make sense.
But they cut themselves off at the knees potentially because they've been losing recruits to Florida State. They've been losing recruits to Penn State. They've been losing recruits to, you know, whatever other school you want to name out of the 757. That was the backyard they had to reclaim, and that win over Florida State did a lot toward doing that. A lot, because that Florida State team has about three or four kids from the Hampton Roads area.
Yep.
A couple playing a lot of snaps down there. So they had a chance to really circle that up to start, you know, pushing back this message of, you know, keeping the in-state kids, stay in-state, win a national championship, blah, blah, blah. That loss to ODU, that was one step forward, two steps back with that. That was embarrassing.
Absolutely.
Because you got a lot of kids now that are in ODU that, you know, might have a lot of pride in where they come from, might be 3-4-star recruits who might have some offers, but might, nah, I want to stay home now. And it's not that kid makes a difference in beating Virginia Tech every time. It's that kid makes a difference potentially in assembling a roster that puts you back consistently in being part of that conversation. And that's what happened toward the end of the Frank Beamer era. They started missing out on kids like that. And so, you know, I do think that if they don't turn this thing around and go out and win 9 or 10 games this season, they could potentially have some issues on their hands like that. Plus, you couple it with kicking off Trayvon Hill, another 757 kid, you know, is now openly taunting you on Twitter and things like that. They could potentially find themselves, you know, with some more problems out there and where the place they need to recruit the best.
I think the Trayvon Hill thing will blow over in time.
It
stings in the moment, and it sounds like a big deal. And you go on any message board, and fans are going to absolutely implode because they think that every kid tweeting means that nobody's going to come to Virginia Tech anymore. And it's an issue, it's a concern, and people don't forget those sort of things. I mean, you talk about high school coaches and friends of Trayvon Hill and teammates and guys in that area. But I think that sort of thing blows over because, honestly, there are character issues on every program and kids get kicked off. And if you hold a grudge over a program because they kicked one kid off, it normally doesn't fester into something any worse. But I do want to ask about Justin Fuente. This is now the third year in a row where they've laid an egg in a game they had absolutely no business losing or hanging close with a really inferior opponent. 2 years ago, they beat North Carolina on the road, in the rain, and then a week later, they lose to Syracuse as 3.5 touchdown favorites. Last year, they played Pitt at home. Pitt was an absolutely atrocious team. I think Tech was 17-point favorite, somewhere in that range, and they needed a goal line stand. They needed a miracle to beat Pitt at home. You talk about the Georgia Tech game the week after beating Miami, or I'm sorry, losing to Miami, and then they lose that game to Georgia Tech on the road. Not quite as bad as the other two, but then, of course, you throw in the Old Dominion game. Does it not raise your eyebrow a little bit? Just a week ago, we were talking about Fuente being an underrated coach, which I still believe in Fuente. Does it not raise your eye that this team is susceptible to severe emotional letdowns?
No. No, I'm not concerned about that. And the reason is very simple, that, as you pointed out earlier, Clemson lost to Pitt. Clemson lost to Syracuse. Clemson should have lost to NC State. It happens. Fair. Not everybody's a football robot like Nick Saban. Not everybody, you know, that's why he's the greatest to ever do it. I mean, honestly, that's what it is. Most guys aren't like him. And I can't put all of that on a single head coach, because the reality is he took over a program full of kids who, you know, he owned them as his own, but they weren't the most talented group, and they had actually become accustomed to kind of mediocrity for a couple of years. So those kids having emotional or mental letdowns is not a surprise to me. And, you know, your quarterback, you know, there's no continuity at that position, you know, from the first year to the second year. And then you get here to the third year, and, well, you've got a lot of young kids on the defensive side who, again, found themselves in a fight and maybe didn't respond the way that you'd like to see some upperclassmen do. So, I don't think I'm ready to call this a trend yet. Ask me this question again next year. I'll probably have a different answer if it happens again. But I'm not ready to make any sort of sweeping judgment about him on that front just yet.
I'll be honest. Before the season, I expected Virginia Tech to lose a game in September, and I thought it was going to be Duke. I thought that the game that's actually taking place this Saturday was going to be that upset where Virginia Tech, if they got the win over Florida State and then knocked off three cupcakes in a row, was going to have that letdown performance leading into the Notre Dame game. But I didn't ever expect it in a million years to be ODU.
No.
And I don't think Fuente either. And a loss to Duke, while not great, would have been way less embarrassing than a loss to Old Dominion.
What? No question. And I'm glad you said that, because I was, you know, of that group saying before the season, Duke's pretty good. Like, you guys need to start talking about Duke more.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
NC State had a good year last year. They lost some things. I'm kind of wait and see mode with them, because that's a lot to replace, right? You get your quarterback back, it's a great start, but I want to wait and see. Carolina, thought they'd be bad. Didn't know how bad, but I thought they'd still have kind of a rough season. But, I mean, Duke was the top three scoring defense in the league. Quarterback who's going to play on Sundays and being taught by one of the best quarterback coaches to ever do it, in David Cutcliffe. And, you know, they're just fundamentally sound. And they've got actual NFL talent on the defensive line. And that's not something we've said about Duke before in the past. I'm not saying first-round talent. I'm not even saying, you know, future Pro Bowl talent. They've just got NFL-caliber talent on the defensive line.
Which is, I mean, that is unusual for Duke.
Right. And so, you know,
especially on the line.
It was predictable that Duke was going to be a good team, and I thought they did stand a chance to lose that game. But I got to be honest with you. I mean, I think Duke's been a little disrespected. I think Duke has been not talked about enough on that side of the division, and I'm guilty in that myself, too. I thought they'd be good, but I didn't take them quite as seriously as I probably should have, and I still don't know how good they are. I don't know how good they are. And until they get Daniel Jones back, we're not going to know how good this team can be, but they deserve a lot of credit for that defense being pretty legitimate, and David Cutcliffe just being such a good, fundamentally sound head coach who always has his kids ready to play.
Yeah, and look, Quentin Harris took over for Daniel Jones a few weeks ago and now is throwing six touchdowns, no picks in his last two games. That was against Baylor and NC Central.
Right.
I don't know the Virginia Tech secondary is that much better after watching him a week ago.
No.
I mean, I say that half jokingly, but seriously, I mean, he's going to have a chance to exploit a young, very inexperienced, very vulnerable secondary on Saturday, and the Hokies are going to have to respond. I tend to think Virginia Tech bounces back this week because of that wake-up call, and I think it's a close game. I would take Virginia Tech in the points if I were to do that sort of thing.
Oh, this would be a rock fight.
I think it's going to be a really tight game because Virginia Tech's, there's too much pride in that program, I think, for the Hokies to allow Duke to go in and walk all over them. And I think Fuente's too good of a coach. I don't think Fuente's going to allow this team to spiral out of control.
Oh, I still think they lose.
You think Virginia Tech loses?
Oh, I know. I think Duke wins. I do. I think they fight. I think it's going to be a rock fight of a ball game. But I think Duke probably kicks a game-winning field goal, or you know, I think maybe a game-winning drive potentially stalls, or, you know, there's a pick by Ryan Willis or something. I still think Duke wins the game because right now they're just better on the defensive side. And, you know, I think this is a low-scoring game. Unless Ryan Willis goes off, and he maybe showed some flashes of that late against ODU, I don't know, but I don't think this is going to be a high-scoring game, but I do think Duke wins.
Yeah, I can see that as well. I think that this game is close, field goal one way or the other, which is why I would take Virginia Tech in the points. Interesting note, I don't know if you saw me tweet this earlier, Kyle. I looked back at the three, well, not counting ODU, the three most memorable upsets of the last 10 years in college football. Talking about point spreads, talking about really inferior programs beating up on the big boys. You had Virginia Tech in 2010, losing to JMU. We all know about that one. You had Stanford knocking off USC as a 40.5-point underdog in 2007. And you had Appalachian State beating Michigan, the one everybody knows about. If you look at what those teams accomplished, the teams that lost, pretty darn good seasons.
Yeah.
Virginia Tech in 2010, we know, went 11-2, won the ACC. Lost to Andrew Luck in the Orange Bowl, but ACC champions. 2007, USC, 11-2, won the Rose Bowl. 2007, Michigan, 9-4, won the Capital One Bowl, New Year's Bowl. I think right now, Virginia Tech fans, if you said, hey, you're going to go win the Gator Bowl, you're going to go win a New Year's Bowl, I think any Virginia Tech fan right now would take that and run with it.
Oh, they'd be over the moon, because a lot of these fans now, they're ready to move on from Josh Jackson. Fair or unfair, right or wrong, they're ready to move on.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody thinks Ryan Willis is going to lead this team to an ACC championship, but there's a kid behind him, you know, Quincy Patterson, that a lot of people want to see, and they want to see him now. And I don't think that's right, but they want to see him now. And if not now, they want to see him next year, right? So,
well, and I think they will. I think that this opens the door now for Jackson to step aside. I could see Jackson transferring maybe four games into next season. Who knows? I could see the torch being passed to Quincy Patterson as soon as the opening night next season. I think that could happen. So for Virginia Tech, I do think they bounce back this year. Close game against Duke. Notre Dame's going to be tough. We'll find out more about Notre Dame this week. I'm still not completely buying Notre Dame, although Ian Book looked damn good against Wake Forest. I got to see them do it against. I got to see him do it against a real defense. Exactly. If Ian Book can go against Stanford and can light up Stanford like he did against the Demon Deacons,
yeah, then we can.
Notre Dame's going to have a really clear path to a special season, and they're not going to have a trouble with Virginia Tech's defense. If Ian Book struggles against Stanford, talk to me next week and see how I feel about the Hokies' chances. But we'll learn a lot more about both of those teams going forward. We got to wrap it up. We got to go. So, Kyle, this one flew by. Plenty to talk about. We'll be back next week. We should have Alex Weaver. She ditched us today. She was supposed to be here. She pulled a Kelly Bryant. She up and left in the middle
She's getting ready for the Roval.
Exactly. She is. It's a busy week there for those folks around that make those four left turns. So, anyway, thank you guys once again for listening. Don't forget to download the podcast, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Google Play, Spotify, all those places. And don't forget, every week, 7 to 8, Kyle and I will be right here talking ACC football with you. Kyle, thanks so much.
Thank you, buddy.
All righty. Thank you, guys. Enjoy the games this weekend.